In October 1915, the first British troops landed at the Greek port of Salonika, and they arrived from Gallipoli and also from France. It was to become known as the British Salonika Force, the BSF, and they fought alongside French, Greek, Italian, Russian and Serbian contingents. There was a total Allied force of around 600,000 within the Allied forces, and 220,000 of those formed the BSF at its peak. Now, there was fighting here in 1915, but the part of the Salonika campaign that we're going to talk about in this week's podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, came in September 1918, which eventually led to the end of hostilities with Bulgaria. And we're going to look at the story of one particular day in that battle through the eyes of the relative of one of the soldiers that eventually died of his wounds that he'd picked up during that final battle. And I discovered about what happened through talking to that relative, Chris Loder, and it's that interview that's going to form today's podcast. So without any more ado, let's get on and listen to what Chris had to tell me, not just about his relative that died of wounds, but about the conditions that those soldiers went through fighting in a front a long way from the Western Front. And to set the scene, we're going to listen to a folk song that was recorded by a man called Jimmy Crowley, and it's simply called Salonika.
My husband's in Salonika, I wonder if he's dead. I wonder if he knows he has a kid with a foxy head. So right away, so right away. So right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier I. And when the war is over, what will the stackers do? They'll be all around the soldiers for the loan of a bomb or two. So right away, so right away.
No, thanks for agreeing to do it. No, I'm just really keen about to get the word out there about Salonika, really.
Yeah, because, you know, it's great because we often say that every day is a learning day, is a school day about the battlefields. And it really is in this case, because although I've been to Greece, I've never been to Salonika. I don't know anything. I had a quick look last night and all I know
that's
is
right.
We were fighting the Bulgarians. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about the gist of it.
So before we go any further then, for the sake of the podcast, we always start by getting you to introduce yourself and explaining how you got involved. What was your interest? What sparked your interest in the Great War?
I'm in my 30s now, but...
Yeah, you're young, one of the younger people I've spoken to.
Yeah, I do get, when I talk to people about the First World War, I do get a few looks and that, because I look younger than I really am. But I've been interested in history ever since I was as a child. And growing up, when I turned into a teenager, I really got into the programme Who Do You Think You Are?
I think
it's really good if anyone has any interest to want to get into family history. So it's a really good starting point to get you inspired. And that's what happened with me. And I had been to one of the First World War battlefields before on the Western Front, because I have a great uncle that died in 1918, and he's buried out in France. And I'd been out there and I'd done a school project on it, but I don't think I fully understood the war at all. And I was probably a little bit too young to really understand it. But it was when I was getting into family history, I stumbled across a family rumor that a relative of mine had been killed in the Boer War. But I knew that that couldn't have been possible on who this relative was, because it was my great-great-grandfather, because my great-grandfather was born after the Boer War.
Oh, so right.
So I wouldn't be here if that had been the case.
Yeah.
So after I did some family digging and that, I eventually found that my great-great-grandfather, Henry Albert Obadiah Loder, fought in the First World War and he died in the Salonika campaign.
Oh, right.
And obviously, that's where the family story came from. Unfortunately, on my direct family line, there's been a few political debates along the way in the family, shall we say, over the years. And I think the story somehow didn't fully come down our family, because like I say, it's in on my direct descent. So yeah, it was quite it's been quite hard trying to piece things together over the years, and because I've had his surname and that, it's always been something that I've felt like we as a family should remember him. And the fact that he's buried in modern day Thessaloniki, he fought in the Salonika campaign, it's an unforgotten, it's a forgotten front, I should say.
It is very much so, yeah.
And that's what really got me into it. I did history at university. I did a BA in history, and a lot of it was on the First World War. But my attention's never really turned to the Salonika campaign. And I think
No.
as I've got older and things, I've just been thinking about him more. And I thought, you know what? Before like all the older generations of my family pass away, I should start speaking to them more. And I've been tracking down various distant cousins, second, third cousins, to try and find out more of a picture about him. And luckily I have. And
Excellent.
it's kind of gone this year of doing all that research that I thought, you know what, I want to go and visit his grave.
So have you been now then? Have you been over there?
Yeah, I went on a tour as part of the Salonika Campaign Society. We went at the end of September, early October, and yeah, that was mainly to visit his grave. But even though for a lot of people it's quite easy to do, to it would be quite easy to do to go and visit his grave, because you can fly out to modern day Thessaloniki. It's in the city centre, his grave. There's a big multinational cemetery out there. He's part of a cemetery that contains British, French, Serbian, Italian graves. Huge cemetery that is kind of forgotten about even in the city. The locals don't even know really exists either. That's quite easy to do. But if you go out there and you visit his grave, then you want to go, well, why was he fighting here? Who was he fighting? What happened to him? And the literature around the Salonika campaign is very thin. It's quite hard to do a lot of research on it, because again, a lot of people don't really know about it.
What about Battalion War Diaries? Have you used those, looked in those?
Yeah, I have looked in the 10th Battalion War Diary, and that's good. But the trouble is, all battalion diaries are very different.
They're dry
Luckily,
as well, aren't they? A lot of them. Very dry, the way they're written.
the 10th Hampshire Battalion that Henry served in, that's actually by other war diaries I've read, that's actually not a bad one. But yes, you have to go to the National Archives and view it. It's not an ancestry like a lot of the Western Front ones have all been digitalized. The ones in forgotten fronts, like even Palestine and the Mesopotamian campaign, the East Africa campaign, if you want to go and research some of those diaries, yeah, you'll have to go to the National Archives to view them.
So you better
So
then, before we go any further, then you better give us a background then to the Salonika campaign. And as I say, the only thing I know about it is that we were fighting against the Bulgarians, but we weren't fighting on our own. We were fighting alongside French and Serbs and Russians and all sorts, weren't we? How did the war break out in places like Salonika then in Greece?
it's a bit of a funny one for the listeners. The Balkans has always been a cesspit of different nationalities, different groups of people claiming bits and pieces over territory in the region. And of course, that's where it all started, with Serbia, Gavrilo Princip, obviously shooting Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Britain and France obviously went on the side of Serbia, who were backed by the Russians. And for the first part of the war, the British and the French don't seem to have too much of an interest in that part of the world. It's only once we get to 1915 that things really start to ramp up. It looks like the Germans have got the upper hand. Britain and France have obviously gone to Gallipoli. Things haven't quite worked out there with the Ottoman Empire. And the Austro-Hungarians are doing fairly well as well. So it looks like the Central Powers have got the upper hand. And Bulgaria, who had fought with the Greeks in the Balkan Wars a few years before the First World War, they had claims over territories in the Balkans. And they were itching at the bit to kind of, and they're looking at the Germans and thinking, this could be our chance to maybe nick a little bit of territory here, because if we go get in bed with them, they're going to help us out. And also for the Germans, even though it would be great because it means from Germany to Austro-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, the Central Powers have got like a long landmass of where they don't have any allies in the way, basically blocking supplies to help the Central Powers on other fronts. So it's kind of important from the Allies' perspective that that doesn't happen. Now, Greece itself was a bit of a divided country. The king of the Greeks, I think it was George the First, you have to quote me on that one, his brother-in-law was actually the Kaiser, and he had a lot of pro-German tendencies, but the Greek prime minister at the time, he was more pro-ally, and he actually invited the British and the French to send troops to Greece to help basically keep it neutral. At the same time as well, the Serbians aren't doing very well, and it means that basically the Germans and the Austrians could really get their foot in the door and take more of a presence in the Mediterranean.
Okay.
So it makes sense for the British and the French to send troops to the region to help support the Serbians.
So Mediterranean is, as usual, crucial to all of this, isn't it?
The
Suez Canal and places like that.
Because if the Greeks go on the German side, they get a foothold in the Mediterranean. They can use their U-boats there, and they can use their submarines to sink Allied shipping, as you say, come through the Suez Canal. Mm. In the war itself, actually, the British never really get on top of the U-boat threat because there's it's forgotten, there was a big Austro-Hungarian presence with their submarines. They've got ports along the Adriatic coast, and they were a bit of a thorn in the side to the Allies. So they were never fully in control. But again, it's that coming back to the sense of like, if Bulgaria does join in the war and it does override Greece and gets places like Salonika, big port cities, then the Med is going to have a big stranglehold for the Central Powers. So what happens is the British and the French, they send a couple of divisions to Thessaloniki, which was then Salonika. And even though they're not a huge presence, it's enough. And what they do is they take a couple of divisions from Gallipoli. There was no logic behind who they sent there. It was just they were the nearest.
The nearest
source of men available. So
they
go to Greece and then march up into to what is kind of the border between Greece and Bulgaria. And they're basically there for a while, but then the Bulgarians, not long after, within a couple of weeks of the Allied troops coming into Greece, they then declare war on the Allies and they join the Central Powers, and then they make a big advance to Serbia, and basically they kick the Serbian troops out of their own country. And they're forced, I think they get evacuated to Corfu. The Allies, the French and the British help them out with the Navy, evacuate them to Corfu. So Serbia doesn't really have a presence anymore. The British and the French, they fight at the Battle of Kostorino in December 1915. And it's not a victory for them at all. They do a tactical retreat back to Thessaloniki. But they think it's important to keep troops there. That, like I say, they want to persuade. They want to get Romania, who's also another big player, onto their side in the war. And then it means that the Bulgarians then have to divert their troops to multiple different fronts.
Stretching it because it's a big front, isn't it? Isn't it about 90 miles from one end to the other?
I think it's slightly more than that. I think it's about 250 miles,
Really? That's a big
front. The British were responsible for about 90 miles.
Right, it's the British front that was 90 miles.
Yeah. Because the British are the junior partner in this with the French.
Mm.
They're getting told what to do. The British, out of all the Allies, they're not really that keen to stay in Salonika.
Well, we haven't got enough men at this stage, haven't we, in 1915? Right.
No, exactly. We've got they've got two divisions worth of men in Salonika, but the French want to keep the troops there. And because of the command structure, the British have very little say in doing it, and they
Right.
do decide to keep troops there. And then that's when in early 1916, because they think that the Bulgarians, they could come and they could break through, because it wouldn't be very far, probably about 70, 80 miles from where their positions were on the border, to come down and take a Thessaloniki. It wouldn't be that far. So what the British and the French do in the spring of 1916, they actually build some defenses called the Birdcage Line. The nickname Birdcage Line refers to the amount of barbed wire that they had to
Ah,
put
is
in
that where it
place.
comes from?
So
Ah,
they
right.
put in lots of trenches, lots of dugouts, lots of barbed wire fortifications that many of your listeners would be familiar with on the Western Front, to basically contain the city. But the city itself in the whole war was never attacked by the Bulgarians. They never really
Got that far.
advanced.
So what does the battlefield look like then? In my head, I can see mountains. Have I just made
Yeah,
that up?
no, it's kind of, you've got like two parts with the front there. On the western side, that's where we've got the mountains, that's where we've got the hills. The French and the Serbians are more towards the west, and then the British and the French forces meet not far from a place called Doiran, where there's a lot of British fighting there. That's where the biggest battles involving the British anyway are. And then as we get round what is Lake Doiran, which is like is a big feature that kind of separates now between Greece and North Macedonia, that is, when we get kind of to the east of that, we get the Crushy Balkan Hills, as our tour guide Alan would call it, because there wasn't much fighting there. And that was guarded by a load of old men who were from garrison battalions. A lot of these guys are in their 50s and their 60s. They were quite useful to the British, because of them, which I will probably talk upon a little bit later, of the malaria out there. They don't get the malaria compared to the younger men that are out there, because they've served in places, they think, like India and the Far
They're
East.
immune
They
to it, aren't they? They're immune to it.
could be immune to it. So they've actually, even though there's no fighting out there because of the terrain, because it's hilly, it's not really tactically strategic to anyone really, to make any fighting out of. They're just there doing a job. So they do a good job, but there's reports of them having to learn how to fire machine guns,
But they've never done it.
how to throw a Mills bomb, things like that. But they've got like arthritis, and they've got lots of probably ailments that stops them from actually being an effective fighting force. It's probably a bit like Dad's army.
Yeah, I was going to say old age is probably the one thing that holds them
And
back.
then yeah, and then once we get out the Cushy Balkan Hills, it's a completely different landscape. It's kind of like the rice fields we think of when we think of like the Far East,
Oh,
like
really?
in places like India. And you can see for miles around, it's very flat. And that was a big part of the British line. That's called what the Struma Valley.
And did they build trenches and dugouts like they did on the Western Front? Was it the same idea?
They did in the Struma Valley. And all around Doiran, yeah, they built the trenches and the dugouts like what you would associate with the Western Front. But particularly in the Struma Valley, because of the conditions out there. I mean, in the summer, I mean, we went out there in late September on the trip, and it's hot then. It's 30 degrees centigrade. But in the high summer, it can get up into the high 30s, low 40s out there.
Really?
And then in the winter, it could be minus 20. So they have kind of both hot and cold temperatures to deal
Yeah,
with.
both
So
ends of the extremes, aren't they? And presumably they're still wearing the same equipment that the men would be wearing, the khaki uniforms, itchy, horrible, thick and hot in summer,
yeah,
and hanging on to
well,
the wet in the winter.
yeah, and basically they can only really fight in April, May, September, October. There is some other fighting that does happen during those parts, but that's kind of like the fighting season. So what happens is that when the troops are fighting in the Struma front, They go down to these positions and they dig in the trenches, and then it's basically there for the summer. And then once the winter comes, they just fill in the positions again, and then they run back to further positions because they don't want the Bulgarians to get their hands on those defences. And, and it's kind of vice versa. So they're kind of going in, I think it's 1916, 1917, and 1918, they do it at least on two or three occasions.
This isn't a short period then. This isn't like Gallipoli where it was like 8 months. This is over the course of 3 years. This is going on for them.
Yeah, it's kind of like a repetitive cycle. And the people that fought in Salonika were known as the gardeners of Salonika in the press back home, similar to the D-Day Dodgers in Italy. It was seen as a bit of a holiday,
right?
But it was no holiday. There have been some examples about, I've seen that from some academics, on people writing about what boredom was like for the troops in Salonika, because at times they were bored. There wasn't a lot of fighting, so they did your typical. They had football matches. Yeah. They had gymkhanas. They had one game where they used to. It was called tortoise racing. So what they do is... So what they do is, you see a lot of tortoises out there. Oh, I saw a couple anyway. What they do, they draw a circle in like the sand or the ground.
Yeah.
And basically, they put two tortoises against each other. Yeah. And it's basically the first one out of the ring wins. And obviously, they would take bets on...
Yeah, they've got something to do, haven't they? Hey, you mentioned about football, and that reminds me that every Christmas, and it will be soon around, we see the famous photograph of footballers, of soldiers playing football on during the Christmas truce, which of course it isn't. The photograph that people always think is that was actually taken by soldiers playing football in Salonika, in the Salonika battlefields. Yeah. Whether you've seen that. As you say, if they haven't got much to do, especially during the winter months, then that's what they do, isn't it? That's what men have done for the last 100 or so years. They turn to sport.
Well, my two times great grandfather's battalion, 10th Hampshire's, I need to do some more research into it. But from reading in their war diaries, they do play a lot of football, and they're one of the more successful teams out in Salonika. There's a lot of 3-4-0 wins. I think they only lost one game from about the 6 or 7 that they wrote in the diary. So
over 3 years, they're playing football. They're bored, like the soldiers say in a lot of their accounts on the Western Front. It was 90% boredom and 10% terror. That seems to be the case on whatever battlefield he served in the Great War. So did you say this was your great-great-granddad?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my two times great grandfather.
Right. Okay. On your father's side, he's got the same name.
Yeah, that's right.
What's his story then? How did he end up out there?
It's quite a remarkable story, actually. And I would say after years and years and years of research trying to find out about him, it's all come at me in the last couple of months, his story.
Right. Okay.
Henry, my two times great grandfather, was born in 1881 in a place called Egham in Surrey.
Yep.
And he was one of 10 children. Yep. And he lived for the first 20 years of his life in Egham. And then he became a master brewer.
Okay.
When he's 22, he marries his wife, Lottie, who's my two times great grandmother. Her name was Charlotte Dalton. She came from King Somborne in Hampshire, and they got married there. And then they went as a couple to live in Staines, which is down the road from Egham. Mm-hmm. They were there for a couple of years. They had a couple of children, and then they moved to a place called Mortlake, where Henry continued to be a brewer. And that's where my great-grandfather was born. And
would have been quite a good job then. He had a trade.
He had a trade. He didn't come from any money or anything.
But they've had a decent quality of life.
They're working class people.
Yeah.
But you know, they're your typical working class family. I would say. They got married young. They have together 5 kids. Unfortunately, one of them died very young, which did happen then.
Yeah.
But they raised four kids together anyway. And then in around about 19, we're not exactly sure when, maybe 1912, 1913, they moved to Andover, where the family have stayed, including my sisters now, lived for the next century, basically.
So he's now in Hampshire then?
Yeah, he is in Hampshire, but his wife's at... His wife's family have always come from Hampshire, so that's why they moved here, to be closer, I presume, to her family.
Yeah.
When war breaks out in 1914, the family get a bit of bad news, because his wife had a brother called Ernest Dalton, and he was a professional soldier, and he'd been in the Royal Scots Fusiliers. There's no connection to Scotland. I don't know why.
No.
He was... First Battalion, the Scots Fusiliers. He joined them in, I think it was around about 1908, and he's sent with the BEF, and he's actually killed on the 23rd of August in 1914 at Mons.
Right.
He has no known grave. So the family quite early on, and it's mentioned in our family Bible that he died.
That's one of the first casualties then, isn't it?
Yeah, he's one of the first casualties. Yeah. In fact, I think he was fighting on the flank down from Morris Dees and Sidney Govley, where
on the bridge there. Yeah.
They were literally right. I think they were the next light battalion, either to their left or right flank. I can't remember which, but they're fighting right in the thick of it, you know. And I think from what I've read in the War Battalion diaries, it's quite sketchy, but they take a lot of casualties. So already the families. Right in the thick of it with the First World War. And then they welcome another daughter along in early 1915. And then a few months after that, I believe he enlisted.
Right. So the key is then at this time, did he volunteer or was he conscripted? He still volunteered at this stage.
He does. The family actually do have his national registration document. But the thing that I come to is that he must have joined in 1915, because I should probably mention this a little bit later, but I'm not giving anything away here by saying he dies and he gets wounded and he has to have an operation. And luckily for Salonika, a lot of the hospital records still survive.
Right. Because his service record is one of those that was lost.
We don't know. We have to piece it together. But in these hospital logs that do survive, I don't think hardly from the Western Front, they don't survive.
No.
But the Salonika ones do. And in his operation report, it actually said he'd been with the unit for around about 3.5 years, which means, and he was wounded in September 1918, which means that he would have been mid-1915.
So what about his medal index card then?
He hasn't got a 1915 star. Which I was told by speaking to other experts, they think he probably was in training.
Okay.
In 19, he's joined, and he's not served, so he doesn't get sent to Salonika until 1916.
Right.
The battalion actually had fought at Gallipoli, because they were part of the 10th Irish Division, which is one of the two divisions. They're quite a well-known division in the army. They are withdrawn from Gallipoli straight to Salonika. That battalion's involved in the Battle of Kostorino in 1915, where they go up into the mountains to take on the Bulgarians in the early exchanges. Right. From what I know, I don't think he was with them.
No, so from a process of elimination and ruling out all of the other facts.
Yeah.
We think he joined arrived them on the battlefield in 1916 because he doesn't have the 14-15 star.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a fair assumption, isn't it?
Makes sense. Yeah, you have to piece everything
you do together. Yeah, you have to be like detectives, don't you?
Yeah, and from a cousin of my grandfather who has all his medals and some of his letters that he wrote down and a lot of his personal effects. He said that he believes he volunteered. But we do have a certificate in the family, which is the National Registration Act of 1915, where he signed his name and his address and his occupation to confirm that he's on that register. But obviously they didn't act on that until 1916. And I was also told as well, he would have had choice of which battalion he wanted to be with.
Yeah.
the head of single men. But again,
Right.
I don't.
No,
I don't.
I'm not
I'm
sure
not
that that's
sure.
true.
That's what Alan Wakefield told me, who's head of the First World War Department at the Imperial War Museum, because he actually ran
Right.
the. He's
Oh,
the
right. In
leading
that case,
authority
well,
on.
he should know, shouldn't
He's the
he?
leading authority on Salonika. So.
Oh, right. Oh, well, we're not going to argue with him then, are we?
Oh, exactly. So
So,
that's what he said.
have you got a photograph of Henry?
I do, but
Oh,
it's not very
brilliant.
good, and it's in civilian uniform.
Well,
He's in his civvies about probably 15 years before he joined.
at least we know what he looks like.
Yeah, and I only literally found it 2 weeks ago from a
And how did
distant
you
relative.
feel when you found that photograph after all these years of wondering about him, when you first
Just
looked into his eyes?
it's just incredible, actually. I mean, I could go on and on with this story, because I sent you my piece, I believe, that I
Yeah.
wrote my trip to the Andover Advertiser, right? And that literally happened round about the week it was published, so not that long ago.
Yeah.
And he had a younger brother that was in the Royal Navy, right? Called Harry.
Yeah.
And I get an email on Remembrance Sunday after I've been to the Cenotaph in Andover when he came, from the first time I've ever done it, to see the military parade there for Remembrance Day this year. I get an email a couple of hours later from a descendant of his younger brother Harry, that lives in a completely other town. But the funny coincidence is, this guy's daughter has moved to Andover, and
Oh.
they're the first generation of that family that's ever been in Andover. And
Right.
she works in the my sister is a teacher in Andover, and they only work in the same school, don't they?
Oh,
You couldn't write that. That
no, that
day,
is a
hey,
coincidence. So that's how
that
you found
day.
the photo then. Did he
No,
talk about
not
his
through that
family?
line, but I'm just saying, like, with
Yeah.
coincidence, it's all happened in like a couple of weeks,
Yeah,
couple
yeah.
of weeks. All
Yeah.
this stuff, it is incredible.
So what we'll do is, if you can send me the photo, we'll put on my website, Terry
Yeah.
Stewart's website. We'll when we publicize this podcast, we'll put his photo on there. It really does bring it home when we can see the man that we're talking about. So he's joined, was it the 10th Hampshires, did you
Yeah,
say?
the 10th Hampshires. Yeah, they were a service battalion,
Right.
which I assume is that they've been means again that they've enlisted, it,
Yes.
from what I've researched into it.
Yeah.
And they're quite an interesting battalion because, like I say, they've been with the soldiers at Gallipoli. They've had a lot of heavy fighting there, and then they're sent to Salonika. But a lot of the men that actually end up fighting, especially in the battle that Henry's wounded at and later died of, his wounds of, there are a lot of elderly soldiers in there, in the sense that they're older men with families. They're not your young teenagers or
No.
your early 20s. Don't get me wrong, they've got a few of those kind of, they do have those ages, but they're not in the vast amounts that you would think of. It's a lot
And
of
at this
men.
stage, when he goes out there, sorry, how old is he?
Oh, he's 35.
Oh, right. So he's not a young man either.
No, so he's got
Oh.
four children and a
Yeah.
wife.
Yeah.
So he's gone out there, and that's again why I say, like, the family had that news, and he knew that his brother-in-law had been a professional soldier, thinking, he's thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to sign up here,
Must
and
have been
I'm
a
not
big
going to.
call, mustn't it? Must have been a big call.
Yeah.
Especially as by the time that he has signed up, obviously he's lost his brother-in-law, but there's a
Yeah.
tremendous amount of casualties in the latter part of 14, and we've had the battle, Second Battle of Arras, and various
Yeah.
other Festubert. Neuve-Chapelle have all gone wrong. So the
Yeah.
casualties are building up. L
Yeah.
losing his brother-in-law, he must have known this was going to be no picnic, and he must have known that the war was going to last a long time, because I think most people did at this stage.
Yeah, exactly. So he was very brave to, like, risk his fat, like, leaving behind his family, and from what I know, when he left, he never saw them again.
Oh, no, he wouldn't have had the chance to come back on leave, would he?
Some soldiers did, but
No.
we can't ever
No, you
find
can't
that.
prove it, can we?
No, yeah. So we really don't know. From what I can gather, he never had malaria.
No.
He doesn't ever enter the log, from what I've that survives anyway, that he had malaria. The battalion were hit quite a lot with malaria during 1916 and 17. They had a sandfly fever epidemic as well, which doesn't sound too nice. And they're down to bare bones in when it comes to men.
So this isn't caused by casualties in battle. This is caused by
No.
disease.
Caused by disease, a very useful stat to know is that for every casualty that's recorded in the Salonika campaign from a battle, 20 of them would have been malaria casualty. And what the British Army has a very good habit of doing is that if you have malaria, go out of hospital, and then go into malaria again with hospital, they count you as another casualty.
Right, so it's double counting.
Yeah, so malaria is absolutely rife out there, and it knocks out lots of battalions. Like, we typically think of a battalion what as 800 men or so, give or take. But a lot of these battalions at full strength, or when they're at strength and they're being sent to the front, they're going in with 400 or 500 men
Right.
sometimes. They're often, and there are sometimes, as you said, there's a shortage of men. This it's if they're especially they're going to go into an offensive, they're going to have to grab and pinch men from other battalions.
So what facilities are there then? I mean, we're very familiar with the Western Front, the process of evacuation, from advanced dressing stations to field ambulance to casualty clearing stations to base hospitals. What facilities are there out in Greece?
Yeah, they do have a lot of transports, but again, because some of the terrain is very inhospitable, they've got to rely on mules, pack mules, a lot, especially from the British side of things. The Royal Army Service Corps are a big help, with their mules, with mule drivers, and they also recruit lots of locals, or people from the region. There's when you go and you visit quite a few graves out there, there's the Macedonian Mule Corps. You see quite a few graves from there. The Maltese Mule Corps as well. And the mule really is like l literally the workhorse. That
Where do they
is.
take them to, these mules, when they get them? So they get the casualties out on mules rather than trains or motor transport.
Yeah,
Do
yeah.
they then have CCSs or hospitals to take them to with equipment?
Yeah, they do.
Right.
There is a railway up to the front, and
Right.
narrow gauge railways as well.
So
So,
they built this infrastructure as the
yeah,
years have gone on, no doubt.
they do have an infrastructure there.
Which means it was a static front then, doesn't it? It means the front line was static, as Western Front was for the
Yeah,
3 years that Henry's there.
it was quite static. On the Struma side, so to the east where Henry was for the couple of years in his war, they did have a lot of fighting there, but it was raids. In fact, actually, the Bulgarians acknowledged after the war, in one source I saw, that that was what they thought the British were best at, was raiding. Didn't read a lot of about that, and a lot of battalions went into very small battles. They went into a lot of small battles, a lot of skirmishes, like smash and grab raids. What they would do is they would go, right, we're going to take a village and we're going to absolutely bombard it, and then we're going to send in the troops to clear it up and take the positions. And what they would hope is that the Bulgarians would just retreat from the bombardment. But the thing you have to remember about the Bulgarians as well, they've got the edge on a lot of these soldiers. Not only do they know the terrain, but they've already fought in the Balkans War 2 or 3 years before.
So they're experienced soldiers that they're up against.
They're experienced soldiers, yeah.
Right.
So they're well trained, they know what they're doing,
Yeah.
and some of these, don't get me wrong, there are troops in there, especially in Henry's battalion, that have been in with them at Gallipoli. They've been soldiers before that fought in the Boer War. There's some, so there are experience, some experienced troops, but you're dealing with an experienced enemy. They're not that they're not soldiers
No.
that are kind of green. They're
No,
not.
they know what they're doing.
They know exactly.
And they're well led,
They know what they're
experienced
doing.
officers
So
and generals.
they do take heavy, sometimes some heavy casualties in these smash and grab raids.
So tell us what happened to him then in 1918.
Yeah. So 1918, they move from the Struma Valley, and they come closer to Doiran. And in 1918, the French General Dessaret, if I pronounce his name right,
Oh, don't worry about it. I'm always getting pronunciations of everything wrong on this podcast.
They're going to do a big offensive with the Serbs in the west, and the British are going to go and attack at Doiran again. That's what they've been told. They don't Lord Milne, who's the commander in chief out there, who's a very underrated commander in chief, I should say. I mean, there's been a bit of a revival in the Second World War of General Slim saying what a great general he was, and he was. But I think people should look at Milne not far off in the same bracket of what he had to put up with, and what he did. But he didn't really want to fight at Doiran, but he's been told that he has to,
But what's the
because they.
objective? What's there? Is it a fortified town? Is it a key defensive position?
Doiran is, you take that, the road is clear to go to Sofia, which is the capital of Bulgaria. But Doiran is the worst place to attack. Many historians and lots of academics have said that the Bulgarian defenses at Doiran were the best anywhere in the First World War, miles better than they had in the Western Front. And they were helped by German and Austrian engineers to a lot of these defenses
And
as
they've got
well.
the terrain, no doubt they're built
And
into the terrain, natural features.
when you go there and you see the terrain, you think how it's a bloodbath. And the British have been told that they need to take Doiran
And
and
what
the
date is
Bulgarians.
this? What actual date? When is this?
So the Battle of Doiran was in the second battle, was in the first one was in 1917, and the second battle of Doiran was in September 1918.
And this is the one that Henry's ends up with as
Well,
well.
Henry's been part of a diversionary battle. He's part of a diversionary attack, which kicked this all off, basically. So they're told that to keep the Bulgarians guessing and to not move troops west to help with the French and Serbs, they need to keep, basically, the British are fighting in Doiran to keep the Bulgarians there so they don't have to reinforce the bigger assault in the west with the French and the Serbs,
Now,
if
I'll
that.
tell you what this bothers me though, looking at it in hindsight as a civilian and someone who's not an academic and is a bit thick, to be honest, is this is September 1918. It's only a couple of months before the armistice. The Germans are in full retreat on the Western
Yeah,
Front.
well, the Bulgarians are very low morale because they're not getting the help from Germany anymore.
No. So why attack then? Why I don't understand
Because
what.
they've been told, the intelligence has said that the Bulgarians are close to surrendering
So
in
they're trying
front.
to knock the Bulgarians out of the war, therefore weakening the Central Powers.
Yeah, basically.
Because me being, a civilian sitting here, if I was looking at this as a business, I'd think, right, let's just hold the ground there, wait for the Germans to capitulate, and then Bulgaria will surrender at the same time, therefore saving all these lives. But military men don't look at it in that way, do
Well,
they?
the Germans actually quite liked the presence of British soldiers being there. They called it, I think it wasn't a prisoner of war camp. You'll have to look up the quote, but they liked basically soldiers being there because it meant there was a load of men. There was like
That weren't on the Western
600,000
Front.
men doing nothing, twiddling their thumbs, basically. So it's keeping them away from like the Western Front. But this is a diversion. So the British have been told that they're going to have to take Doiran or fight there again, and they don't want to fight there really because they know from 1917 how difficult it is, because half the casualties, or more than half the casualties in the Salonika campaign from the British battlefield casualties anyway, they're sustained at Doiran. It's an absolute bloodbath, absolute bloodbath. There's one battalion in the first battle, Oxford and Bucks, they go in, I think it's something like with 500 men, they come out with 40 men unwounded and they lose all their
So they're
officers.
annihilated, aren't they?
They are not absolutely annihilated. I think it's seven socks, Oxford and Bucks. It's a bloodbath. But
Those.
the tact that Henry's been told, so it's a position, it's kind of hard to explain. It's a bit south, it's kind of now southwest of Doiran, but it's kind of a strategic point where they've been told that they have to attack it to basically keep the Bulgarians guessing. It's a surprise attack. And it means if they take that point, they basically can't divert troops to the west. They're cutting off an access point of sending troops across,
And of
basically.
course, Henry Loder will know nothing about this. He'll know
No.
nothing about the strategic situation or what's going on in the world. He will only know what's happening in his bit.
No, exactly. But to be fair, this is a successful attack.
Excellent.
They are very well prepared for what they have to do. They trained for this for about 3 months.
So they've practiced.
and they know everything. I mean, I've looked at the war battalion diary for the battle, and the men were, they knew what they were doing. They're not going in there like headless
All
chickens.
ranks, all ranks.
Yeah, all
Not just the
ranks.
officers
Yeah,
or
all
NCOs, but all
ranks.
ranks,
A
yeah.
private to the
And
major.
what rank was Henry? Was he a private
He's
soldier?
private, yeah.
Yep,
There is a
okay.
family legend he was a sniper, but we'll never know.
No, there always got to be family rumours that
One thing that's interesting about him, though, about him is he is mentioned by name in the War Battalion diary when he dies of his
That's very
wounds.
unusual, isn't it?
Later, yeah,
Yeah.
they name his company he was in as well, so that
Ah,
helps
right, that helps you drill down, doesn't it?
pin down. So,
Okay.
what happens is, so Henry's in D Company
Yeah.
in the 10th Hampshires, 10th Hampshires. But from what we do know, they're very well trained. They basically got to take two hills. The 10th Hampshires are taking the left, and the 2nd Gloucesters are taking the right. They go in on the 1st of September. I should say before this, they've been bombarding these
Yeah,
positions
in traditional way.
for a couple of days. You know, the tactics basically of the Western Front with the creeping barrage, it's basically now it's
This is a
their first
successful
key.
tactic.
They know what they've got the latest battlefield tactics. So they go in. The Gloucesters have kind of a smooth passage. They do meet resistance, but they take their objectives quite easily. The
Okay.
Hampshires, moreover, they have a little bit of a difficult task. There's a lot of heavy machine gun fire on the hill that they take. And in fact, one of the companies, it could have even been Henry's company, they're a little bit behind the creeping barrage. So they're a little bit late to get going. And Henry's company, D Company, they're cut off. From what I can gather, Henry was wounded by one of the machine guns
Right.
because his wound is described as gunshot wound in the right arm.
Right.
He
Okay.
take he sh He's wounded sometime on the 1st of September 1918. We don't know when, but
Right.
his captain was Captain Grelier, and he's actually awarded a military cross for his action.
Okay.
It says that his company became badly disorganized, and he went and he rallied them. And despite himself being wounded and the company suffering heavy machine gun fire, they get organized and they basically do take their objectives in the end.
Right.
They've got a bit more resistance, and the Hampshires do take quite a few casualties. I think they have a, again, this is always hard though with some of these casualties and statistics, because I don't know how they say, oh, there was 130 wounded. And so I think there was 130 wounded, and there's 47, 48 men that die.
From the battalion diary, that information.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but they're men that are wounded that do die of their
Die
wound
later, yeah.
within a couple of weeks.
Well, it's
So,
just a snapshot, isn't it, on the day that
yeah,
officer writes the diary. That's what he knows at that time.
that's what that yeah, that's what they include. And there is about 14, because I made sure when we went out there, I visited every single man that
Every one of
died.
them. So, how many died, did you say?
Roughly about 42, 43,
42. Okay.
there and there.
But what happens to Henry then? Because he's
So,
wounded, he's been shot in the arm. Do they get him out of the front line?
He goes to 40th Casualty Clearing Station,
Okay.
and he's there for a few days, and then he gets transported back to what is Salonika, to the 28th General Field Hospital. The family get news on the 9th that he has been wounded and he's out of danger. And it was dated in the telegram that he was moved on the 6th of
So
September.
you're quite hopeful at this stage, aren't you? That
But
he can
when
get back to all these
the
base
day the
hospitals.
family get the telegram on the 9th
Yeah.
is the day he has his operation,
Right.
remove his arm. And it actually tells you the surgeon that performed it. His name is St. John Dudley Buxton. He was a major, and he was only in his early 20s when he
Oh,
performed
blimey.
the operation. Actually, he went on to have a hell of a life. He actually was a one of the leading surgeons in the UK, and he
Oh,
retired in
right.
the 1960s, and
Oh,
he lived
right. That's
till he was
long.
nearly 100.
Yeah.
And I've actually been to the Royal College of Surgeons archive in London, and I ordered his files, and he's actually left a few diaries behind
Oh,
in his
right.
Salonika. And he said that the period that he's operating on Henry was the worst period he had in the
Because of
war.
the numbers, the volume of them.
He gets 12 hours sleep or something like that in 8 days.
Oh, God.
So he's at work fully in this period. And this is before really the second Battle of Doirans got going.
So he's amputated his arm then, has he? And then talking about disease then.
We believe he died of an infection afterwards. Yeah. The family legend that he could have got gangrene, we don't know for sure.
No, it could have been anything, couldn't it?
He died on the 14th of September, so he dies about 5 days after the operation.
2 weeks after he'd been wounded initially.
Yeah, and then he was buried in Lambeth Road Cemetery.
Which and he's so close to coming home, isn't he, at this stage?
Because the war actually ends officially on the 30th of September 1918. The Bulgarians come to the negotiating table and sign an armistice.
So way before the Germans,
Yeah, so a couple of months before the Germans.
But even then, even if they hadn't, having gone through the evacuation and the medical procedure, the next stage would have been, they would have got him home, wouldn't they?
And
history in your family would have been different.
Exactly, because his widow after the war did remarry and they had a daughter together.
Right.
So obviously if he didn't die, then
that daughter wouldn't have been born.
My great granddad wouldn't have had a half sister. So it is very sad. And it's just sad it was forgotten in my family for so long. Mm. I mean, we've actually been to talking about Henry. We on the tour, it was actually on the very first day we actually went to Karasuli Cemetery, which is where all the people that died, or they died in the casualty clearing station within a couple of days after the battle, were buried. You know, and that was quite moving. And all the headstones out there are slightly different to in those cemeteries anyway, are different to your typical Commonwealth War Grave Commission ones that you think of, like on the Western Front. I mean, Henry does have one at Lambeth Road. But when you get into the more rural areas in Greece, they have a lot of earthquakes.
Yeah.
That means that the stones are more fragile.
Are they flat?
Yeah, they're all flat. Yeah. So they're all like that. But I think I wrote in my piece about the Andover Advertiser, it reminded me of the famous quote from The Soldier by Rupert Brooke, for wherever I should go, there should be a piece of England. It does remind you of England.
So tell us about the tour then. We know about the background of the battle. We know what happened. We know what happened to Henry himself.
Yeah.
History's gone on and your family has evolved, and generations later you come along and then you decide, you said there's an association for
They're called the Salonika Campaign Society.
Yeah.
And they've been born out of years, if you go back through the years, if you go back far enough, they've come from what is the Salonika Reunion Association, which was a veterans organization set up after the war. And it got disbanded in the late 1960s, but some relatives of the men, and even some of the men themselves that were still not around, they wanted to stay on.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
And that's kind of how the society comes to this day. And Alan Wakefield, who's I think he's the chairman of the society.
And he said he works at the Imperial War Museum.
Yeah, he's the head of the First World War Department at the Imperial War Museum. He's the leading authority on everything Salonika, and he goes out there with the Salonika Campaign Society every year, and he gives private tours as well on other tours. There's other tour groups you can go out there, but he gives a tour every year.
So this was a public tour that you signed up to, that he ran.
Exactly. And there were people there from all around the world that were on this tour.
How many were on it?
I think it was about 22 precisely, but yeah, so there was about 22 people on the tour. There's people out there that have got a connection to Salonika with a grandfather that fought there. There was no one actually that went on the tour that had a connection that died out there.
You were the only one,
Yeah, there was quite a few guys that had people that had malaria. Their grandfather had a malaria or left a baby behind about their time. There were people there that they just had a relative that was, like I said, that was based out there. And then there was people that came from America. There was a colonel from NATO that came on the trip. A retired colonel now. And he's just interested in military history. And
it's always fascinating, isn't it, to talk about your story with other people.
Yeah, and he's come out to learn about the campaign. There were people from Canada on the trip.
Yeah.
You know, there was a real different group of people on the trip.
So how long was the trip for?
Just over a week. So,
oh, right, quite a long time then. So you must have seen a lot of the battlefield. And
oh, yeah. Well, they do a different theme every year. This year was about the British, but next year they're going to do one on the RAF, which they've done before. And again, you wouldn't think the RAF in Salonika.
No, that's right. So we had air support there. Then.
Yeah, so we had air support.
Right. So the important thing is then on this tour is when you go to see Henry's grave.
Yeah.
And presumably they knew about your background and that you wanted to go to this cemetery.
Yeah.
And built that into
they go there fairly regularly because it's one of the biggest.
It's one of the obvious places.
Yes. Yeah. And it was quite funny actually, because we go there on the weekend before the tour ends. And on the first day we went, like I said, we went to Karasuli, the cemetery where he would have been if he got killed straight away. Yeah. And we went to the battlefield that he got wounded at.
To the place where he was wounded.
Right. Yeah, and I actually got a little ball of shrapnel as well that we found.
Oh, right. Excellent.
So, how
did you feel then? What's the cemetery he's in, did you say? What's it called?
Lendon Road.
Okay, how many burials are there?
There's round about, I think it's about 1,500 British graves.
So most of these guys will be guys that have died of their wounds. So
either their wounds.
Identified, no unknown burials there? All identified?
Not many.
No. What's it like? Describe that. Is there grass? Right. Is it a grass cemetery? And
it's quite. As I say, it's the cemetery has a lot of other graves there from other nationalities, and there are different zones and sections. But to get to the British zone, you've got to walk through the French graves, and that's all like gravel, small crosses. They're not like as well maintained, they don't look as appealing as your typical Commonwealth war graves, and you have to walk through there, and it's quite eerie walking through there, and like you feel, I don't know, it's hard to get your head around it. It kind of feels eerie, but then when you get to the British graves, you feel a little bit more at home and relaxed and. At peace, probably because
it's familiar. It's familiar.
Yeah, it's familiar. Exactly. Yeah. Where everything else is unfamiliar.
And have we got a cross of sacrifice and a stone of remembrance?
Yes, they do. And Our Lady Reef there. I read a speech out to the group about his life.
That must have been quite emotional then.
It was, because even though there have been a couple of relatives that have been out there before me. My grandfather's cousin that has all the medals and stuff, he'd been out there 25 years ago.
Right.
And I found out more recently another distant cousin had. But no one like that probably has read out like a eulogy or a few words about his life. And I doubt that anyone said apart from the vicar or the priest, would have said earth to earth, ashes to ashes.
Did you hold it together? Did you hold it together?
I did. A few other people were in tears, but I felt goosebumps from head to toe.
Yeah.
I managed to hold it together. I didn't know how I was going to react.
No. It's strange, isn't it? Because we're talking about people that we couldn't possibly have ever known.
No. But,
you know, as we're doing the research and, you know, they live with us, don't they, on this journey as we look into their lives and their backgrounds and their families. And by the time we get to see their grave, they're part of us. We feel as though we know them very, very well.
He's my grandfather's grandfather.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I'm still lucky. My granddad's still alive in his 90s.
Still alive,
You know, and you think that's my position. I could be in that position. And
that's right.
And the fact that nobody from our family and it's all been forgotten about and... Mm. And that not really been out there from our particular side of the family. It's important, and it's my family name as well. So
that's right. Yeah, well, it's not going to be forgotten about now. You know, we call this podcast "Tales from the Battlefields," and this really is a tale from the battlefield, isn't it? In more ways than one. And it's certainly not going to be forgotten about because, you know, this podcast is heard, played all around the world. You know, no doubt other people will be going out there. And hopefully someone else who listens to this podcast will go and pay their respects to him as well. It's an incredible, like they all are, they're all incredible stories, aren't they?
Yeah, well, my intention
is very personal. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, my intention is to actually, I have started the research already, well underway. I'm going to be writing a book on his battalion.
Excellent.
On Salonika, because...
It's not been done before?
No. Well, I don't even think the Hampshire Regiment Museum hardly know anything about it.
Really?
I'm actually visiting their archives on Thursday. Saying earlier, they're quite an extraordinary battalion because not only have they got older men, but their brigade is the 82nd Brigade, and they're in with a lot of 1st and 2nd Battalions. So they're
Regulars.
in with a lot of regulars. They've actually had to come up to scratch on these men. Don't get me wrong, some of these regulars, they're getting raw recruits as well. But they've had to come in and do the hard yards. And some of the characters in the battalion are extraordinary. Like, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the officers are the easy ones to do the research on, and it's your privates, like my great-great-grandfather, that are harder to do. Like,
Well, it's the newspaper archives, in my experience. That's
yeah,
where you can get so much information from.
there is. But one example, like, that's definitely going to be in the book. I'm going to write it around probably about 10 individuals and key points about their
Yeah,
journey
great idea.
about.
Yeah, it's a personal touch, isn't it?
But there's this one guy that I was at the National Archives, and I literally went down a rabbit hole. His name was Second Lieutenant Benet, and in 19 I think it was in 1916, he gets court-martialed for being drunk on duty. And then 2 weeks later, after he's been court-martialed and he's been given one final warning, he gets taken prisoner by the Bulgarians. And then they have to have a court of inquiry to see, did he go under his own steam to basically go
Did he go
away,
staggering across no man's land
or
under the
was he
influence?
genuinely taken prisoner? So he is, they come to the conclusion, the officers swear that they hadn't seen him drink anything, and he was legitimately taken prisoner. So he was, and the confirmation gets back a few months later that he was in a raid, a surprise raid, or patrol. He got caught. So he goes back to Bulgaria. The war, as I say, it ends in the end of September. Not long afterwards, about 6 weeks later, he's rejoined the battalion again. But this time, they've got nothing to do. There's no fighting. They're on essentially peacekeeping duties, really, waiting to be demobbed. And he's on duty again. And what does he do? He gets caught being drunk again. This time, they throw the book at him. He's dismissed from the army.
Oh, no
And
pension for him, no
yeah,
medals.
no. But after he leaves the army, he ends up joining the RAF as a flight sergeant
Oh,
in the
right.
1920s. And by this point, he's in his late 30s.
I hope he stopped drinking then if he's up in a plane.
Yeah, well, there you go. And then he gets married when he's in his 40s to a much younger woman. And then I find him after the Second World War, he ended up being a caretaker in a school. So you've gone from being a lieutenant in the British Army, where most of his contemporaries, you think, and he wasn't privately school educated, but he's been to like grammar school and that. You think from when you're that background that you're never going to fall to those kind of lows.
No, that's right.
And
You never know, do you? You never know, especially if you've got a drink problem.
because a lot of the officer files do survive, I've seen some of them for the 10th Hampshires, and they're just like that thick. They're just standard. They've got bits of paper and then they're still quite interesting documents.
The
But here's
problem
what
is when you
I
go down to queue, when you get those files, you spend hours looking at them, and then you realize you've
Yeah.
run out of time to look at all the others.
Well, his one was like a s encyclopedia, and it's just this court martial, and it's just like someone could make a television drama into it, right?
Oh, well, we'll look forward to that book then. I'll tell you what we'll do then. I'll wrap this up now, but when you get round to doing the book, these 10 individuals, you'll have to come on
Yeah.
and give us a summary of them, and then that'll be a good way of getting your
Yeah,
book on the
exactly.
road,
And
won't
also as well, if anyone's got any relatives that even just served in Salonika that's listening to the podcast,
it? Get in touch.
feel free to get in touch with me, because again, this is totally forgotten. Probably a lot of people listening to this podcast, even if they had a relative that fought in the First World War, they might have fought in Salonika, but they've not known about it.
No,
So
that's right. So how do people contact you? You got an email address?
yeah, I've got an email address. It's christopherloader2304@gmail.com.
Excellent.
Or they can
Okay.
follow me on Twitter at LuckyLoader15 and give me a DM.
Lucky loader.
15, yeah.
Thanks for
That's
that.
all right,
Thanks very
guys.
much for a
Sorry if
great
I've
idea that
rambled on a
was to
little
come on
bit.
and talk about Salonika, because as I say, I never really thought, well, I hadn't thought about it at all. I know that my local regiment, the Northamptonshire's, one of their battalions, was out there. And I'm now going to go back and look at more detail at what they did, because I can now piece it all together thanks to what you've told me in the last hour or so. So
Well, there was a lot of
fantastic.
Yeah, a lot of Hampshires as well. There was two Hampshire battalions.
Yeah, so there's a lot to get on with, isn't there? It will
Yeah,
never
there's
end,
Hampshire.
will it, research into
Well,
World War I?
yeah, exactly. I've gone down rabbit hole that I'll never get out of now.
That's right. Rabbit holes, yeah, we've all done that, haven't we? And well, I hope you enjoyed that. Something different this week, a long way away from where we're normally talking about on the Western Front. But maybe we'll do some more of these podcasts in the future where we go further afield and find out the bigger story of the Great War. So next week I'll be doing my first battlefield tour of 2024, and I'll be meeting some podcast listeners, a family from New Zealand, a family of four, and I'll be taking them around the places of interest for the New Zealand force that came over and fought with such distinction on the Western Front at places like Messines and the Somme. And I think what I'm planning to do, if the weather conditions are right and everything else falls into place, is record a podcast whilst we're on the ground. So that will be coming up towards the end of the first week in January. But for now, as usual, we'll play the last post in memory of all those soldiers, and in particular, Private Henry Loader, 10th Battalion of the Hampshire Regiment, died of wounds on the 14th of September 1918, aged 37.